Shavuot Tov, and Yeshikov for people for coming up for learning in such weather. It should be better by the morning. So if you can come to the morning at 9:15, Dr. Shapiro will be talking on learning Torah on Christmas Eve. Actually, we were at KST in the morning, so I don't know if the rabbi told you. Rabbi Kanofsky said he read your article. He still will not learn. And he meant it also as he does not learn Torah on Christmas Eve. I don't know if you also don't learn Torah. I'm not so religious, so I try to learn Torah on Christmas Eve even, but you can come to hear the development of a very interesting custom. Anyways, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Shapiro with us. I'm sure everybody here knows more or less who he is. He's the last person to receive a PhD under Dr. Chwersky at Harvard. He's been teaching at the University of Scranton for many years, holds the Weinberg chair there. He wrote, of course, the book on the Sri Leish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, a fascinating work. And, of course, he recently wrote a book a few years ago already on the Rambam, on the Yud Gimel Karim, on Shaul Lieberman and the Orthodox, Maimonides and his interpreters, and his latest book, which is supposed to be coming out in 2-3 months under Litman Library on truth in halacha, something like that, or the misuse of truth that often goes on within our system. So that should be a fascinating book, like all of them are. He's a great speaker. I invite all of you who don't have plans in the summer, and even if you do have plans, to try to fit in one of our trips. You know, please go out to Spain, Italy, or Central Europe. We have the flyers out there. So without further ado, Bakashat, Dr. Mark, and I'm speaking on a fascinating topic. I'm Rabbi Avadi Yosef.
Well, thank you all first for coming out, braving the storm. And let me say that the book will be out hopefully in the spring, but I'm stalling a bit because I see people walking down here. If they made the effort to come all the way here, I don't want to miss the first minute. But it's going to be on censorship and in Jewish rewritings of truth, things like that. I'm happy to see people who come on various trips of mine. So I'm holding off till you guys sit, and then I feel comfortable starting. Okay. So the title of the talk, it's not important, the title. It focuses on Rav Avadia Yosef. So I'm trying to see if I can get anything taller here. Taller? There's something. It's very hard for me to look down and look straight. If there's something bigger, and that'll stall a minute for the person who just walked in also to come in here. Yes, here. That's fine. Perfect. Thank you. And as I said, I thank you all for braving the storm. Okay. Thank you. What is it now? 2 months ago, I guess, there was a funeral for the great sage, Rav Avadia Yosef, in Jerusalem. Reports said 800,000 came, which itself is an unbelievable number. But listen, think of this. If you looked at the pictures, all you saw were men. And we're not dealing with men, in the 90s or 80s. We're not dealing with little kids. So now when you consider the percentage of the population of Israel, you have to double it because no women were there. And then you consider the fact that no Arabs were there. So when you think of it that way, it comes out to actually 22-23% of the Israeli male population was in attendance at that funeral. I mean, it's an unbelievable number when you think of it, how many people. I'm leaving out the people like very old or children, but the people who could attend of the Israeli. There's never been a funeral like that in Jewish history, ever. I mean, I wasn't at King David's funeral. But we have never had anything even close to that. So obviously we're dealing with someone quite unusual, quite special. Now, outstanding rabbinic figures, of which Rav Avadia was one of them, don't usually merit critical biographies in their lifetime. They don't merit. Usually this is after their deaths. And yet Rav Avadia, there was two biographies written in his lifetime, real biographies. A quasi-biography, which is also a scholarly book. There's a work that speaks about Israeli society, and it focuses on him and Aaron Barak, who was the Supreme Court Justice, and presents each with a different vision. So, I mean, as well as numerous other materials. So we're dealing with someone, again, who's unlike any other rabbinic figure in that he's the subject of such study in his lifetime. Obviously, those who know, Aaron Barak was a Supreme Court Justice. He represented secular Western liberal values, and Rav Avadia Yosef you know, the rabbi, the traditional values, and the book is talking about these are two alternate visions of a future Israel. Well, what is it, or what was it? I'm going to speak present tense, actually. What is it about Rav Avad Yosef that makes him so special and significant? And it really comes down to a combination of the religious and the political. Now, without his entry into politics in 1983, there's no question that his reputation would have, first of all, he would have had a lower profile, but his reputation would have been helped to a certain extent. And while his reputation in religious circles would have remained great, even greater perhaps, he would not have the wider significance currently attached to him. There is no question that Rav Avadya Yosef is the only rabbi in the state of Israel whose picture is recognized by every single inhabitant of the state. And that itself says something. Two of the books that I mentioned were are complete biographies which show the complexity of the man who came from a humble beginning. No yichus, like we think of great rabbis, you know, that's usually the common thing. He has no such yichus. He comes from very humble beginnings, and he becomes the most important rabbi in the world, according to Yehuda Mirsky's article, the most, in recent issue of, was a tablet, the most powerful rabbi in history. He was also one of the leading power brokers in Israeli society. Incidentally, I'll just point out, since we live in an era where kashrus, you know, is going crazy about what you can't do left and right, I'll just mention that it's interesting, you know, since we live, I don't know about Toronto, but there's some places where rabbis have even begun to declare that you can't even get a coffee in a Starbucks unless the institution, unless the establishment has a hechsher. It's very nice to read in one of the biographies how Rav Avadya used to take his talmidim, his students, to the coffee houses in Cairo and, you know, take them there. It's perhaps well there that he, you know, achieved his or gained his first appreciation of Arabic music for his entire life. By the way, he had a great love of Arabic music, including Umm Kulthum, the Arabic singer, if you know that. If you read The Man with the White Sharkskin Suit, you probably know that. But he's a great lover of her music from 40, 50 years. Now, a feeling that comes through with the various books on Rav Avadya is that he is a paradox, and he presents a paradox for anyone studying him. On the one hand, he is a man whose sheer knowledge is unmatched. None of the other great rabbinic figures in our time even come close to him in terms of sheer knowledge. And it's impossible to take seriously a so-called chief rabbinate when Rav Avadya Yosef was not the chief rabbi. As mentioned already, he is a man who comes from humble beginnings. There's no yichus here. He achieved all of this on his own. As we know, many times rabbis, they're placed in their position because of their parents, their fathers, or other things, fathers-in-law. Rav Avadya had none of that. And throughout his career, he had great courage and compassion, be it during his time in Egypt, where he fought against communal leaders that didn't care about Jewish law, were not interested. He spent sleepless nights after the Yom Kippur War going over numerous files. I think it was like 900 different agunot that he did not rest until every one of these agunot were freed. So it's not surprising that he earned the admiration of hundreds of thousands, observant and non-observant alike. And as I mentioned, his funeral was the largest in Jewish recorded history. And those who are close to Rav Avadya, who were close to him, know him as a man who was loyal and honorable and was prepared to suffer the slings and arrows of others in the name of truth as he saw it. Yet the paradox is that the man who literally spent every waking hour devoted to the most advanced levels of Torah study in later years following his entry into politics, and it's only following his entry into politics, he consistently showed a side more reflective of the low culture of his youth. There is, to be sure, a positive side to this, as no other scholar in the Sephardic world was able to achieve this connection to the masses like he did. As anyone who ever attended his Saturday night shiurim, he used to give in the Bukharan section there, a Saturday night shiur, which I attended in 1985, my year in Israel, you could see his connection, the way he used slang and Arabic, and he connected to the masses, stories. This is a quality he had since his youth. From the time around 17 years old, he started giving shiurim, and he immediately attracted a following. So on the one hand, this low culture, coming from the low culture, meant that he was able to form this attachment to the masses, which you saw, as I said, in the funeral. He was the man that they came out of. We'll get back to this point in a few minutes. Yet together with this, Rav Avadya was known for many shocking statements, as well as for cursing out this or that politician, including religious politicians, and promising heavenly rewards to those who supported his party. Not surprisingly, the secular newspapers carefully monitored his talks, and in the last 10 years, they would send reporters constantly to his talks. Actually, I shouldn't say that. They always sent reporters to his talks. The last 10 years, they didn't need to send reporters because he has a website, maron1.com, and you could watch all the things. And what they carefully monitors his talks, waiting for the next juicy quote, which routinely would come every few months. There'd be another such quote. Perhaps the most embarrassing of these came after Hurricane Katrina, where he declared that this was retribution for the Bush administration's support of the Gaza disengagement. And as to why New Orleans was hit, why that city, he said, well, because that's where blacks live, Kushim, and they don't study Torah. So that's, I mean... There are plenty, and we laugh about it, but at the time it was a huge embarrassment, and this is just one of numerous such statements. Now, there are plenty of similar examples that show that we're not dealing with someone who occasionally misspeaks, as we all want to do. Rather, we're accustomed with a basic facet of Rav Avadia's personality, or best I should say personalities, as he seemed to have more than one. It is no longer surprising to anyone who followed his career that the same person who soared the heights of Torah scholarship could be counted on routinely to come up with what in the minds of most people are some of the most offensive rhetoric of any Israeli public figure and brought even ADL condemnations on him. The man who brought Shas into a labor merits leftist government, an action which brought down upon him the wrath of much of the ultra-Orthodox world, was also one who famously called Yossi Sarid, a leader of merits, Haman and Satan, saying, quote, God will uproot him just like he uproots Amalek. The same man who declared that land can be given back for peace, which was a position he had for decades, also publicly referred to the Arabs as snakes. So already we see that we're dealing with a complicated figure. In addition to documenting this aspect of his career, two of the biographies that have appeared that I mentioned deal with other things that would never make it into a typical Haredi hagiography, but which are well known. For example, they deal with the difficult relationship he had with his son, Rav Yaakov Yosef, who predeceased him, and who was a great Torah scholar, but through much of the last 30 years was completely, they were completely estranged, the two of them, Rav Yaakov Yosef and his father. In fact, Rav Yaakov Yosef would attack his father's positions, and that's never an easy thing. Both of the volumes that I referred to, which I highly recommend, quote, extracts of Rav Avadia Yosef's unpublished diaries. And in them, you can find all sorts of negative comments about his predecessors, including his early opponents, including his predecessor as chief rabbi, Rav Yitzhak Nissim, as well as the famed Mekubal Rav Yitzhak Kaduri, who, in his role as amulet writer and object of veneration, later became an important part of the Shas machine. He would give out amulets. And because of that, the Israeli government had to pass a rule that you were not allowed to give out amulets and, public, and you know, promise heavenly rewards as part of your political campaigning. So he became an important part of the Shas machine and appeared constantly. And yet, in the biographies, both of them, I think it's both, it's definitely one, you have negative comments about Rav Kaduri. So what's going on here? There's no explanation as to how these passages from Rav Avadia's personal diaries show up in these biographies. And when I asked one of the writers, he wouldn't tell me. But I think the logical assumption is that Rav Avadia cooperated with the writers and gave them his diaries, sections of them. And why would he give them this material about Rav Kaduri? I think this is also obvious, because although he tolerated it and he needed this to get the masses, the simple Sephardic masses who go for this sort of thing, to vote for his party, he wanted people to know that he really doesn't believe in any of this stuff. And he doesn't have veneration, and he thinks this is all mumbo-jumbo. So on the one hand, he has Rav Kaduri with him, but on the other hand, he has published his unpublished diaries, which say all this stuff, that this is all nonsense, because in the 1950s, he came out publicly against Rav Kaduri. So that's the only way I can explain it. And when the author of one of the books wouldn't tell me where he got it from, obviously there's a reason why he's not telling me, because he was told not to, and it must be that Rav Avadia gave it to them. No, Benny Lau is a fourth book, which I'm not even going to mention, and I don't like it all. Benny Lau's book, which is a study of Rav Avadia's halakhic writings, is what I call politically correct scholarship. It's how it got a PhD, I have no idea. Do you know the book appears, it's supposed to be an academic book, with an approbation from Rav Avadia Yosef? How can you write a so-called scholarly book and have an approbation from the figure? I mean, it's beyond the imagination that that's regarded by some people. It's a nice book. It gives you an introduction to his Rav Avadia's halakhic ideas. It's not a biography, but as I wrote once about it, this is politically correct scholarship. And, how can you ever, well, you'll see some of the ideas I'll talk about in a few minutes. it's not a hagiographic in the sense it's not a biography, but there's certain aspects I'll get to later with Rav Ovadia Yosef's writing. You have to ask hard questions. But how can he ask hard questions if this is an official work with an approbation? Who ever heard of an approbation? You write a biography, let's say, of Bill Clinton, and you ask him to write the approbation for it. I mean, the whole idea of an approbation means that someone is declaring that this is acceptable. But that's not the academic world. We're not writing for the subject of the writing to declare us. So it falls between it's not a hagiography because it's not a biography, yeah. What'd you say? He did it for sales? I'm sure he did it for sales, but I understand. But you know something? Okay. He might have regretted it after he saw what I wrote about it. Because at the end of the day, sales are important. We all want sales, but you can't sell, you know, your soul if you're trying to write an academic. This is a PhD dissertation, and then you want to get a, you know, you want to be taken seriously in the academic community. You can't ask the rabbi to write an approbation. But I understand he did it for sales. But now, in seeking to understand Rav Ovadia, you can view him in his totality, everything I'm talking about, or you can completely separate his halachic persona from his political persona. And I believe that Rav Ovadia Yosef's halachic scholarship can stand on its own, should stand on its own, both in the area of research and how we view Rav Ovadia Yosef. Unlike his curses of this prime minister or that, which hopefully will be forgotten by future generations, the halachic writings will remain forever, stand the test of time, and I don't believe they have any relationship to his more polemical side. You can reject his polemics, you can reject his politics, but everyone must respect his halachic achievement, and I say this now to anticipate future questions. You know, people have difficulty with some of these statements, well, what does that say about his halachic achievement? I do think, as we say in Rabbinic Hebrew, zelachud v'zelachud, the two can be stated. Obviously, if you write a biography, you need to discuss all aspects. But in terms of his halachic achievement, as we'll see, I believe you need to separate them. Now, since Rav Ovadia took positions not in accord with the Haredi leadership, it's not surprising that he was the focus of much of their anger, the Ashkenazi leadership, that is. Much of this has to do, first of all, with the political positions he took, and second of all, Shas's emergence as the leading fervently Orthodox Orth party, which marginalized the power of the once important Ashkenazi Haredi parties. When he was allied at the beginning with the Ashkenazi Haredi parties, in their newspaper, Yated Ne'eman, he would get all the titles that if you understand Rabbinic Hebrew, you know that certain titles are given to people for great sages. You're referred to as not just rabbi, you're given all these super titles. When he parts ways with them, then all these titles fall by the wayside, and it's permissible to attack him in all sorts of ways. Now, it's not only Rav Ovadia Yosef's political outlook that brought down the wrath of the Ashkenazi Haredim. I mentioned already that after the Yom Kippur War, he worked tirelessly to free the Agunot. This was an important element in cementing his reputation as an outstanding halachist posek. And the responsum he wrote, pages and pages, is required reading for anyone who deals with the issue of Agunah. Yet in a recent Haredi work that discusses this episode, Rav Ovadia is referred to as Ovadia, without even the resh, rabbi, before his name. He's also derided as one who, quote, will rely on a responsum, even if it is from a book that is not accepted, such as some author from Egypt or something similar. I would merely add that for the Ashkenazi Haredim, no author from Egypt in the last few hundred years would ever qualify as, quote, accepted, as their perspective is entirely Ashkenazic-centered. Standard works in the Sephardic halachic tradition, works such as Erech HaShulchan, Petach HaDevir, Yafei Lalev, the numerous works of Rav Chaim Palachi. I'm not sure whether any of these works are in this Beit Midrash. These are standard works in the Sephardic halachic tradition, are not regarded with any significance by the typical Haredi posek and hardly ever quoted, and the Ben Ish Chai is only maybe quoted a tiny bit, and he's a basic posek. In other words, they have a completely different canon than the Sephardic world. Now, although the dispute over the Agunot issue was one example of the halachic disagreements between Rav Ovadia and the Haredi leadership, the fact remains that had he not taken a different political line, he still would have been regarded by them with great respect. In fact, in the early years of the Shas party, when you know who the dominant figure? It was Rav Shach, Elazar Menachem Mount Shach. He was really the person in charge, and Rav Ovadia was political protege. The titles that mean so much in the Haredi world were also attached to Rav Ovadia's name in the Haredi press. And the thing about titles, it might seem stupid or silly, but if you read rabbinic writings, you know what it's talking about. So, for example, a great rabbi is referred to Hagaon, Harav. Someone not so great is referred to Harav Hagaon. and you know, you have Zatzal after the name. If you're just a typical run-of-the-mill rabbi like Rabbi Soloveitchik, you'll get Harav, nothing else. And you might not even get Zal. You might get, like, one place he's referred to as Ayin Hey, Olav HaShalom. I mean, these are things which for the outsiders maybe don't have meaning, but for people in the world, you know that this is the difference between a real rabbi, a great rabbi, and just a run-of-the-mill rabbi, or sometimes just get a resh with a little dot, a line next to it, you know, like Reb. So, and that's, if you read the Haredi newspapers, you know who's on top and who's not. And that really defines the society. But when I read these attacks on Rav Avadi Yosef, I confess that it reminds me of like a gnat taking on an elephant. I mean, Rav Avadia just marched on, oblivious to all these things. He knew that if he fell into line with their Das Torah, that their, you know, political viewpoints, that he'd be given all the respect. But what is he needed for? He's the one that has all the power. And the harshness of the attacks that got more and more over the years were the response of a society slowly losing power. There was a time when the Ashkenazi Haredim controlled the Haredi vote. It was Rav Avadia who had all the influence. And he rejected the authority. You know, all the talk about how he rejected the authority of the Gedolim, it didn't really mean anything, because not only did he have the influence, he also would get the purse strings when they took over the interior ministry. And he became the religious power broker in Israel. Now, this is quite a success story, considering the fact that in 1992, towards the beginning of the Shas party, Rav Shach famously declared that Sephardim were not yet capable of leading. This comment, coming on top of decades of discrimination against Sephardim in the Ashkenazic school system and society, was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of Shas breaking off on its own. This comment by the leading rabbinic figure in the Ashkenazi Haredi world, the leader of the Haredi parties, to declare that the Sephardim were not capable of leading, led to a strong feeling of ethnic identification with Shas by Sephardim of all levels of religious commitment. Rav Shach's picture was ripped up in development towns as people declared that they would never again vote for the Ashkenazim. Shas plastered Rav Shach's patronizing words on walls throughout Israel, while loudspeakers passed through the streets, playing the tape over and over again, skillfully stoking the flames of, I guess you would say, anti-Ashkenazic sentiment that would rebound to Shas's advantage. Now, the contempt with which the Ashkenazi Haredim have treated the Sephardim is so well known that there's no need to deal with it here. And it's paralleled, of course, in general, Ashkenazic non-Orthodox society. Suffice it to say that despite any recent court decisions, Israel has not yet had a Brown versus Board of Education, if you know that famous decision in the United States, and the Haredi school systems continue to discriminate and see nothing wrong with it. I'm sure you remember a few years ago, you had a school in Emmanuel that actually set up a wall, a fence, where the Sephardi girls play on one side and the Ashkenazi girls play on another side, and they didn't see anything wrong with this. Yet I would note that Rav Shach's comment was not as bad as it appeared. And the truth of the matter is that Rav Shach, in his lifetime, always was interested in the Sephardic people and the Sephardic youth. He had a connection, he had many students, and he over and over again insisted that this Ashkenazic school system must take in Sephardim. Of course, the leaders of these schools didn't listen to Rav Shach. I mean, they wanted to do what they wanted to do, but Rav Shach always was at the forefront of insisting that that the girls must be taken to the schools, etc. So then what to make of this comment that Sephardim are not yet capable of leading? What he meant was that, and this was clear if you read the whole context in the speech, Ashkenazim, due to their historical experiences in Europe, know how to deal with anti-Torah forces. They have been dealing with Haskalah and Reform for over 100 years. And it was with reference to this battle that he said Sephardim are not yet ready to lead, because the Sephardim never had an experience with anti-Torah forces. You never had this in the Sephardic world of people against Judaism. You had people, you never had denominations, you never had anti-Torah movements, you never had atheism, you never had any of these things in the Sephardi world. And therefore, his point was, and this was spayed in particular because Shas was saying that we should make a deal with merits. Because what's the difference? Shamir is a Machal Shabbos. So Rabin and Labor, and Sari, they're Machal Shabbos. What's the difference? They're all Machal Shabbos. And Rav Shach's point was that it didn't matter that the Likud party, yes, they're Machal Shabbos, but at least they have a more of attachment to tradition. And that it's precisely because the Sephardim have never dealt with this sort of, you know, atheistic type of secularism, that they don't realize that how dangerous this is, and that there is a difference between this Mechal Shabbos and that Mechal Shabbos. Now again, you might not accept what I'm telling you as a great justification, but that is what he meant. He wasn't saying that's something genetic or anything. He was simply saying that the Sfaradim don't have experience dealing with them. We've been dealing with them for 150 years. Yeah.
What about it?
No, there's never there. We're talking about dealing with Haskalah, with reform, with secular Zionism. You never had this. And that's what he's saying. He's saying that the Sfaradim, the fact that they're willing to make a deal with merits, with Shalom and Aloni, and Yossi Sarid, shows that they think there's no difference. And Rav Avadi himself said there's no difference. He's throwing Machal Shabbos. So what's the difference? Yeah. Okay, so you make a good point there, that the truth of the matter is that Rav Shach is wrong. That you had, you did have, in, for example, in North Africa, you had a school system set up by the French Alliance, which definitely was interested in secularizing the Jews. And there's no question about that. You had it in Yemen also. They even, all of North Africa, you had it in Egypt, the population in Egypt. When Rav Avadi Yosef was in Egypt in the 1940s, the community leaders were all irreligious. They wouldn't even make the old age, the hospital kosher. And these are people who ate non-kosher. These are, so there's no question that Rav Shach was wrong, that the Sfaradim, people like Rav Avadi Yosef, had dealt with it. Although maybe he would say there's a difference between an Egyptian Jew who's a Machal Shabbos and everything, and but basically still, you know, they still would go to shul. Versus someone, I mean, you take a typical Ashkenazi after two generations of secular living in North Tel Aviv, he doesn't even know what Shabbos is. I mean, Yitzhak Rabin was given an aliyah, I think it was at KJ when he came to America once. I think he was ambassador, actually, when he was, and he didn't even know how to make the bracha on the Sefer Torah. I mean, there's no question that even with the secular, I won't say secularism, even with the irreligiosity that you refer to, in North Africa, let's say, you still never had a form of secularism. You never had atheism. You never had... But that was what Rav Shach was getting at least. He thought that the Sfaradim didn't appreciate it. And many would say that Rav Shach showed prophetic insights. And shortly following the statement, Shach breaks away from Rav Shach's leadership. And he forms himself on their own. And he takes Shach into a government in which Shulamit Aloni was the Minister of Education. So, and that, many people proved Rav Shach's point, that Rav Avadia didn't understand this. But in truth, the Shas Ashkenazi break was inevitable. Sephardic society was ripe for a party, an ethnic party, that would encompass the larger community, which, while not, quote, orthodox, if you want to use that term, had a strong attachment to tradition. We know the Sephardic approach, where they have a strong attachment to tradition, even if they themselves are not completely halachic. There was a need for such a party. And what about those Sephardim who had been educated in the Ashkenazi Haredi school systems and had begun to create a Sephardic Haredi culture, which is not Ashkenazi Haredi, but it's not religious Zionist, it's somewhere in the middle? How long were they supposed to submit to the rule of Ashkenazic sages who conducted their deliberations in Yiddish and had no place at the table? You know, there were Sephardic great sages, Gedolim. They were invited to come to these meetings. The meetings all took place in Yiddish. I'm not making this up. I mean, how long were the Sephardim supposed to stand for a situation like that where they were showed that they're really not taken seriously? And here we come to Rav Avadia's true significance. It was he who single-handedly restored the pride to Sephardic Jewry. The slogan of Shas, L'hachazir atara yoshna, to restore the crown to its glory, says it all. Rav Avadia ushered in a new era. You heard this in the eulogies if you watched the funeral. All those people there would never have been there years ago. All the yeshivas, all the Torah students, this is all because of Rav Avadia Yosef. You never had Sephardic yeshivas in the 1960s, 50s. You had one, Barak Yosef. Everything that's been achieved is all because of him. Rav Avadia ushered in a new era, one in which Sephardim were no longer regarded, or no longer regarded themselves, as second-class citizens, either in society or in the Torah world. This was a great social achievement and is the reason why so many Sephardim, who are not Orthodox, voted for Shas. Now, as I said, we know that Sephardic society has different levels of observance. And many of them would send their children to the Shas school system. They set up school system throughout all of Israel. And this, over the almost two generations now, was able to raise up a whole youth. People who came from traditional backgrounds, who would have gone to the Mamakti Dati, were sent to Shah schools, they opened up high schools, they opened up kollels. This is a creation that was from Rav Avadia Yosef in the last 40 years, from almost nothing, Yesh Me'ayin basically, to a whole society of Sephardic Torah scholars.
And from this perspective, there's nothing surprising about the widespread Sephardic support for Shas. Yet what makes his achievements even more significant is that until the Gaza withdrawal, he and Shas were identified with dovish political positions. In fact, some of them still are. One of the members of Shas, a member of Knesset of Shas, spoke at the J Street conference a few months ago. You can see it on YouTube. And Rav Avadia was always identified with the left, politically. He had a very good relationship with, for some reason, he hated Shamir. He always cursed him out, called him a pig eater and all these things. And yet, Shimon Peres, who was, as far as I know, although in recent years he's come back to religion, his whole life was lived as a complete secularist. Rav Avadia had a great love for him. When Shimon Peres was prime minister, they would learn once a month. He always had a great attachment to Shimon Peres. But in general, Rav Avadia's politics were always on the left. And he is firmly convinced that he could give back land. Now, the views of the typical Sephardic voter are much to the right of this. You know, they lived in the Arab world, and they have no love for that. And they were the ones who brought Likud to power. And yet many of them were willing to overlook their differences politically with Rav Avadia in order to support him. And this is a testament to his incredible drawing power, that they were willing to vote for him, even though they did not accept his politics, because he was Chacham Avadia. I mean, he could have, and this shows also, I think, the honesty and the, I guess you could say the, I don't know what word, other word to use, but the greatness of Rav Avadia. He could have gotten more votes. You know, when he made his, he, I think 13 was the most he ever got, but had he adopted a more hawkish approach, had he been a hawk, he could have pulled in even more of the Sephardi masses and had more seats, but he didn't do it because he says, that's not my approach. I believe, he was always honest with the voters, that I believe in returning land. What soured? What soured was not the halachic argument. What soured was he thought there was no one to return land to, and therefore giving back land in Gaza is just going to create more terrorism. But the idea that you can return land if there's a real peace partner, he remained firmly in this viewpoint to the end of his life. And yet, as I said, if he was a politician, he could have got more votes. You know, but Netanyahu, the first time he was elected prime minister, the second time, he was very hawkish. As soon as he comes into power, he starts talking to Syria about giving them the Golan. Ariel Sharon did the same thing. So Rav Avadia could have done the same thing, been very hawkish and then come into power and, you know, gone to the left. He didn't. He let people know from the beginning. So I think that has to go to his credit, that he didn't try to fool the people. Now, one should not think that it's only Shas that, for political reasons, spoke about the Ashkenazi-Sephardic divide. Rav Avadia himself has made a number of comments critical of Ashkenazi society. And this is not only directed to the Ashkenazi, to the Sephardic masses, but reflects more serious concerns. In the introduction to the first and the third volumes of his response, Yabia Omer, he disputes with the yeshiva world's approach to Torah study. That is, the way they study in the Ashkenazi yeshiva, which is all theoretical, and trying to study lumdus for the sake of study. And he argues that the purpose of Torah study is halacha lamaseh. You want to know the practical halacha. So he's very critical of that. One of his first acts as chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1969 was to permit Sephardim to marry from the 17th of Tammuz to the 1st of Av. The Ashkenazic practice forbids this, and the Ashkenazim controlled Tel Aviv, and the Sephardic rabbis didn't feel that they could go up against the Ashkenazim, and the Ashkenazim didn't allow them to get the marriage certificates. As Rav Avadia explained, while other chief rabbis of Tel Aviv, the Sephardic ones, were not prepared to go up against the Ashkenazic hegemony, he is, and therefore he changed the rule. Along similar lines, there is a dispute. If a woman needs to have the levirate marriage, her husband dies and she doesn't have any children, so she has to have a brother. In the Ashkenazic world, we do chalitza. The Sephardic, you know, the spitting ceremony, in the Sephardic world, they did levirate marriage. There's a dispute going back to medieval times. The Ashkenazim wouldn't do that because they said that today, you know, people doing the levirate marriage, they don't have the right intentions. So when the state was established, Chief Rabbi Ben Sion Uziel, the Sephardic chief rabbi, agreed with his Ashkenazi counterpart that today, you know, Sephardim are not so great either. They don't have the same right intentions. So he agreed to sign a Takanan ordinance that even Sephardim could not do Yibum, levirate marriage. Rav Avadia overturned that and said that we don't change our practices just because the Ashkenazim want us to, and he reinstituted Yibum for those, you know, for those people who want to do it. Although Rav Avadia's tshuvot always show respect for Ashkenazi scholars, even when he's rejecting their opinions, this has not been the case always when he speaks to his followers. A storm arose, just to give you one of numerous examples. after Rav Avadya downplayed the significance of the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish is regarded as the most important 20th century Haredi figure. He's really the one who crafted the Haredi response to the State of Israel. Yet Rav Avadya had none of the feeling of awe when it came to what, for him, is just another Ashkenazi scholar, prominent though he may be. In this case, he went so far as to declare that the Chazon Ish is not to be regarded as a posek, as a mora hora'ah, because he was only a private citizen without communal obligations. A real posek is one, according to Rav Avadya, who has a community and has to deal with people. Someone writing on their own books without having to deal with the, you know, the results, the consequences of what you write, does not have the status of a real posek, he says. Furthermore, he added that the Chazon Ish, quote, loved to be stringent, adding chumrot on top of chumrot. And that applies, that comes into this first thing I said, because if you don't have to deal with individuals, you're just doing this in your books, you can add chumrot, but when you have to deal with the masses, you can't add chumrot. The storm that arose after that was unbelievable. Now, for those who only know Rav Avadya of recent years, who towered over Shas with great political clout, it will be surprising to learn how the party, as I mentioned, was brought into being with the blessing and guidance of Rav Shach, and how Rav Avadya in the early years was a pawn of the Ashkenazi leadership. And the story of how he summoned the courage, finally, to break with the Ashkenazi hegemony, to agree to take Shas into that labor merits government I told you about, is inspiring, to me at least, and it speaks to his great motivation and the faith he had that the people would follow him, as they did. Now, the Haredi response was severe, as he knew it would be, but he made a shrewd move. It catapulted him into political power, and from 92 until his death, his party was the leading Haredi party, and he was the leader in that respect. I mean, as I said, it's the idea that the Sephardim would take the Ashkenazi Haredi paternalism and just, you know, live with it, wasn't being realistic. In terms of his long-term significance, there is no question in my mind that Rav Avadya Yosef is the most important Sephardic figure since Rav Yosef Karo. And it can be truly stated that from Yosef Karo to Avadya Yosef, from Yosef to Yosef, there has arisen none like Yosef. In fact, Rav Avadya Yosef is referred to as Maran. There is only one other Sephardic figure after Rav Yosef Karo who is referred to as Maran. We have another expert on him. It's the Chida, Maran Achida. So Rav Avadya Yosef, before Rav Avadya Yosef, the second most important Sephardic figure was Chaim Yosef David Azulai. If you go on this Italy trip this summer with me, you'll learn more about him. And Rav Avadya Yosef is also Maran. But unlike other Gedolim, great figures, who were his contemporaries and giants, no question about it, men such as Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Avadya was not simply a giant in his day. He has accomplished the very rare feat of altering the course of Torah history in both a sociological and religious sense. You know, what do I mean by that? Well, it's typical that even the greatest figure is only great in his own day. And 100 years, 50 years, they're forgotten about. And that's the normal way. I mean, I could say names of towering figures in the 19th century, and people wouldn't have heard of them, because only a few, there's only a couple figures who remain important in later years. Take Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example. He dies in 1986, I believe, or 85. There's no question that his halachic influence is nowhere near what it was during his lifetime when he dominated Torah Jewry. And if you come to Brooklyn, you'll see that up close. In his lifetime, no one dared put up an Erev in Brooklyn because he was opposed to it. And now there's Erev in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, in Borough Park, in Flatbush. People are carrying. I mean, people always had the approach, different than Ramosha, but no one would have dared to. And you have numerous examples where you see that, which is, as I said, the natural progression. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's views have been jettisoned in favor of Rav El Yashiv. However, Rav Avadya created a halachic enterprise which permanently altered, I believe, the halachic tradition of Sephardic Jewry. And I'll give you some examples. First of all, I have to say his tendency was always to be lenient. In fact, in the months leading up to his election as chief rabbi, he publicly stated that his approach, and that of the Sephardic rabbis in general, was that of Beit Hillel, who's known for leniency. He contrasted that to the Ashkenazim, who always like to be stringent, and are their followers of Beit Shammai. That's what he said. While there are exceptions to this lenient tendency, and the most famous is his consistent ruling from day one for 50 years that shadels are absolutely forbidden. That's the one great chumrah he had, always against shadels. Women are forbidden to wear shadels. They have to wear some sort of other head covering. His tendency, his general tendency, is definitely in the other direction. examination of his tshuvot, dealing with mamzerut and agunot, show he is a man aware of his responsibility and almost always able to arrive at a lenient decision. The final address for the most complicated questions in Jewish law for the last 40 years has been Rav Avadi Yosef. There was never a question he could not answer. Even with his Haredi tendencies in recent years, when push came to shove, he showed that he had a Klal Yisrael sensibility. This was seen most clearly in his idea about the Heter Mechira. We know that in the sabbatical year, the land is sold for the Heter Mechira. The last sabbatical year, it'll be interesting to see the next one, but the last sabbatical year, the Ashkenazi rabbi refused to go along with it, Rabbi Metzger. I mean, the whole idea of how this guy became chief rabbi, I mean, the scandal, it is unbelievable. If you want, I can explain to you exactly how this happened later. This shows you how low this Ashkenazic rabbinate came. But he refused to sell the land. That's why he was put into office, one of the reasons. The land in Israel, 95% of land in Israel is owned by the government, even farmland. You know, they rent, they lease it out. All this land was sold in Rav Avadi Yosef's house. All the land, because he said that yes, it's better not to do this, but we're not at a stage in history where we can do that. And the people, many of these non-religious, they're still going to go work the land. And there's chumrah to not to work the land, but then there's a hetter, there's a kula, we can sell the land. And that is a psak that deals with everyone, not a psak just looking out for some people in Bnei Brak and Yerushalayim. This is a psak that's dealing with everyone. Or when it came to his decision made a few months before his death, there's all this disputes about the army conversions and not accepting them. Rav Avadia called the chief rabbi of the army, Rabbi Peretz, to his house. I think there was something like 15,000 conversions were being questioned by different Bati Din. He signs a letter stating that all these conversions are valid. And that was the end. No more discussions. No one. And as his son explained, yes, Rav Avadia would have preferred that they would require more. But after the fact, these conversions are all valid. This is a Klal Yisrael sensibility. Rav Avadia's tshuvot have multiple levels. He often gives you the halacha and then tells you, if you want to be stringent, do more. But the basic halacha is for the average person. If you want to be stringent, you can be stringent. But we don't tell the average person that this is what you need to do. That's the beauty, and this is what he learned since he was in Egypt, that you have to give, there's halacha, and then there's stringencies. Rav Avadia was not like the Ashkenazic Gedolim. He really cared for the non-religious. You can see him on YouTube meeting with all these people, be it Gilad Shalit's father, there's a video there of him meeting, just plug into Hebrew, you'll find it, one of these Israeli soccer teams, the Israeli championship soccer team, when all these people come to him. These people don't even know how to dress when they come to the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage of the generation. They're in jeans and t-shirts, and yet he sits with these Israelis, typical Sephardic, types, and you know, they come afterwards, he used to give them a little slap on the face and everything. You know, for the Ashkenazi Gedolim, they have no interest in these people. I mean, this is not their community. For the Ashkenazi Haredi, yes, in a sense I could say that these Gedolim, the Ashkenazi Gedolim, they love all Jews, perhaps, in that way. But they really don't care about them. It's not their community. They care about their community, their people. Rav Avadia really cared about the person in the poor development town of Netivot, about this person, about the Ethiopian. When the Ashkenazim refused to accept the Ethiopians, Rav Avadia says, no, we're going to accept them. I mean, here's someone who literally cared about every person, even with the Haredi tendencies, with the soldiers. When he made some sort of comment about, we don't want yeshiva students to go to the army, it came out sounding like he was against the army. And so then he didn't want that. So he brought in all the soldiers, a group of soldiers. You can see this on YouTube also, to explain to them how what they're doing is so valuable. He loved the soldiers. He just thought that for people who are learning Torah full time, they should be learning Torah, but if you're not learning full-time, you should go to the army. Unlike the Ashkenazi Haredim, there's a big misconception here. The people are saying that they're arguing that if you're a yeshiva student, you shouldn't have to go to the army. That's a falsehood. For the Ashkenazi Haredim, no one should go to the army, even if you're not in the army. I mean, if you're not learning Torah. They don't believe that any Ashkenazi Haredi should enter the army. It has nothing to do with learning at all. Rav Avadia, he had nothing against secular studies. He valued secular studies, but not for... And his daughter opened up a school for the Haredim to help them, study secular studies. But if you're learning Torah, you shouldn't force them out. So here we, and let me tell you a story. Hold on to the questions. I'll be done just 15 more minutes. I'm going to tell you a story that's never appeared in print, but I heard it when Benny and I was by a book came out. There was a Yom Iyun in Jerusalem, and one of the Hezder Rosh Yeshiva told the story. You can listen to it online. And this shows you something about Rav Avadia. When I say about the Ashkenazi Haredim, you know, they're only concerned about their own mosadot, their own institutions, their own communities. They don't have a sense that, you know, I think it's the Ger Rebbe. He doesn't speak, they say he doesn't speak to anyone who's not a Shomer Shabbos. I mean, the idea that we don't have anyone in the Ashkenazi world who really is a leader for the entire community. It's just their Kehila. That's it. Here's the story, and I'm going to tell you, as it was told by the Hezder Rosh Yeshiva. He got a call from one of his students who was a chaplain at a hospital, I assume in Jerusalem, because the yeshiva we're talking about is in Jerusalem, that there was a girl there who had just given birth. And there's no family. You know, you expect someone who just gave birth, you'd have, there's no husband, and there's no parents. And so he asked the girl, you know, what's going on? What's going on? And she said that, you know, she came from a traditional, a typical Sephardic family, and her father had become a chassid of Rav Avadia. You know, so he became like a Baal Tshuva, and he listened to him on the radio. Rav Avadia had a show every Friday, and he became very attached. And the girl, you know, this was after the kids were old. She remained her lifestyle. She had a boyfriend. She got pregnant. I can't remember whether she was estranged from her father before she got pregnant or after. But what she told the chaplain was that, you know, her father, she can't tell her father. That's why her parents are not there, because she can't tell them that she's pregnant. She just had a baby. You know, he'll never accept her. You know, he's very pious now. And so he called up, the chaplain called up this Rosh Yeshiva, Hezder Rosh Yeshiva, and Hezder Rosh Yeshiva called the Rav Avadia Yosef's office and explained the situation. What happened was, shortly following that, the phone rings at this man's house that Chacham Avadia wants to speak to him. It's sort of like, I don't know if you have this in Canada, but in America, every year on Thanksgiving, you know, the president calls a few soldiers, and that's like a big deal, you know, out of the blue, hold for the president. I mean, it's for a man like this to be called by Chacham Avadia, that's a lot more important than even here getting a call from the president. I mean, Avadia Yosef, his idol, wants, you know, to call him. What is this? And he wants to speak to, well, he didn't say, he said he wants to meet you. What does that could be? So the man comes, and this is told by the Rosh Yeshiva, who was there at the event. They comes to Rav Avadia Yosef's house. It's in Har Nof. And they let him in, and the Hezder Rosh Yeshiva is there, and Rav Avadia, there's some schnapps and cake on the table, and Rav Avadia says to him, your daughter has just given birth to a son. I want to make a l'chaim with you now, and then when you leave here, I want you to go there and help raise that child. Matoro, chupa, masim, tovim. I mean, this is something that you literally, and it's sad, but you cannot imagine someone other than Rav Avadia, you know, in the Ashkenazi Haredi world ever doing, because he doesn't feel a sense. Rav Avadia knew that these were his people. Even with his Haredi tendencies in recent years, this is where he came from, and fundamentally, this was his people. In other issues, by the way, you see his lenient tendency as well. Let me get back to that. Take gelatin, for example. The American Orthodox rabbinate has generally followed the rulings of Rav Aaron Cutler or Moshe Feinstein that gelatin is not kosher, and that's the policy adhered to by the major kosher organizations. If anything is able to change matters in the United States, I guess Canada as well, it's Rav Avadia's emphatic response that all gelatin, whether from bones or pig skin, is kosher. Similarly, his response that one dishwasher is sufficient for both meat and dairy, eminently reasonable on pure halakhic grounds, goes against the consensus in this part of the world, but as with all consensuses, is liable to change. Another great leniency that would be unthinkable in this country or in America is his ruling. He was asked about a restaurant in Israel that serves milk products immediately after meat, or even together if they're both cold. Can it be given a hashkacha? You know, on the one hand, so how could it be given a hashkacha? It's serving milk and meat together. It's not cooking it together, but it's serving it together. You get it. And, or after, one after the other. And he says, not only can it be given a hashkacha, it must be given a hashkacha. The Tzitz Eliezer was crazy about this and attacking it. He says, a restaurant asks you for this hashkacha, it's going to serve meat and serve dairy right afterwards, or even serve it together. Serve you some salami and then serve you cheese together with it. You must give it hashkacha on the meat. Why? Because if you don't give it hashkacha, then it's going to be serving treif. It'll serve non-kosher meat. And at least this way, we keep the people eating kosher meat. So you're going to say, well, what's the sign? It's not going to say anything. From people who are not eating in a restaurant like that. But at least the non-religious are eating kosher meat. You don't need to worry about what it's going to lead to. Rav Avadia says, he calls it a chovah kedoshah. It's a holy obligation to at least, we lessen the sins. Look, we can't control what people do. I mean, if I own a supermarket, I'm selling meat and I'm selling cheese. If people want to go in and take them and make a cheese meat sandwich, they can do that. So too, if we'll put hashkacha on the meat. We're not saying that it's okay to eat meat and cheese together. The hashkacha is not on; it's simply on the meat. that the meat and the cheese are kosher. And if you choose to eat it yourself, that's not a good thing, but at least, and think of all the people who don't put it together. At least they're getting kosher meat. And Rav Avadya says, it's a chova kedosha. And this is what I mean when I say a Kol Yisrael sensibility. It's a sensibility. He's not happy with restaurants like that, obviously. But it, you know, stop him from eating treif. Why not? Operating in an environment far removed from conservative Judaism, and thus not feeling any threat to the halakhic process from the conservative approach, he's able to reach decisions without dealing with, you know, what's going to happen. For example, he has the bat mitzvah celebration has been the subject of so many tshuvot in America and other places, and they always deal with, well, you know, what's it going to mean? You know, what's it going to lead to? The conservative, this and that. Rav Avadya doesn't have any of these concerns. He simply looks at it. It's a simcha. Why not? It's a simcha. You know, the Ben Yishai mentions it already. So, bat mitzvah is fine. It's beautiful. Do it. Rav Avadya's vision is clear. A Torah society in the land of Israel in which the Sephardic authorities lead. And the halachot in this society are to be guided by the Shulchan Aruch. And in some of his writings, you even get the sense that Rav Avadya feels that Ashkenazim also in the land of Israel are bound by the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch, because this is the land of Maran, the Shulchan Aruch. But in other places, you don't get that at all. Because he deals with Kitniot, for instance. He talks about Kitniot, and he assumes in these tshuvot that Ashkenazim are bound by Kitniot. And if you're going to say that he held that all Ashkenazim have to follow the Shulchan Aruch, then that would make no sense. But I can tell you that in recent years, we've seen something interesting. I had this question, what about, can you become a Sephardi if you're an Ashkenazi? And when I say become a Sephardi, I don't just mean the Kitniot, I mean the good and the bad, you know, the Gat Kosher, all the things. And I wrote to two of his sons, and I published this on the blog that I write for, and I published their replies, the copies of their replies. One was Rav Yitzhak Yosef, the current chief rabbi, and one is Rav Avram Yosef, who was going to be the chief rabbi until certain things came up. And Rav Avram Yosef says, yes, you can. And Rav Yitzhak Yosef said, no, you can't. Both saying that this is the view of their fathers. Rav Yitzhak thought, there have been other disputes, by the way, dispute over between Rav Yitzhak and Rav David over the bracha on Bamba. You know, what they each claim to be representing. Rav Yitzhak said, if you're a Baal Tshuva in Israel, you adopt the Sephardic approach. But otherwise, Ashkenazi has to be Ashkenazic. Shortly before Rav Avadya passed away, a volume was appeared of his oral responses to questions, and in there it states explicitly that Rav Avram Yosef is correct. That although on a public, and for the public at large, he never said that Ashkenazim should abandon their practices, privately, when Ashkenazim would ask them, can I become Sephardi? He told them numerous occasions, yes, you can. Again, everything, the good and the bad. So according to Rav Avadya, I, living in Israel as an individual, could become Sephardi and follow the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch. And that makes a lot of sense, what he's trying to get out. He deals with Kitniot and things like that because the Ashkenazim generally keep that, but they don't have to if they don't want to. Yet even with regard to Sephardim, I have to say that Rav Avadya's position that everyone needs to follow the Shulchan Aruch has been quite controversial. It first comes to the fore as a young man. He starts lecturing before his community, the Iraqi community, and the Iraqis, who are their authorities? It's the Ben Yishai. They have a figure called the Ben Yishai, Yosef Chaim, and that to them is the most important source. They follow that lock, stock, and barrel. And sometimes the Ben Yishai says things different than the Shulchan Aruch, and they follow the Ben Yishai. Rav Avadya began to tell them that you should not listen to the Ben Yishai. That's for when you were in Baghdad. Here in the land of Israel, the Shulchan Aruch is the rabbi of the land of Israel. And this created great controversy. It even got to the point where people wanted to put him in Cheirim in the 1950s. They disrupted his shiurim. They burnt one of his early books. For them, it was unforgivable that he's telling them, the Ben Yishai, who is their Shulchan Aruch, you don't have to listen to in the land of Israel. And in fact, Rav Avadya's tradition is hardly traditional, his position. As far as I know, he is the first posek in history to make such a far-reaching claim as to the significance and binding nature of the Shulchan Aruch. Every previous posek that I know of recognized that there were practices, communal practices that existed before the Shulchan Aruch or parallel to it, which never accepted the Shulchan Aruch's ruling. And even the Shulchan Aruch itself in the introduction says that if you have a practice that diverges from me, you can keep this practice. And Rav Avadya doesn't accept that. He says everyone has to follow the Shulchan Aruch. He's less tolerant than the Shulchan Aruch was, because he says that the Shulchan Aruch has now become the accepted authority in the land of Israel, and therefore everyone has to fall into line. Let me give you an example that illustrates the problems this position has created. There's a big dispute, an old question. Do women make a bracha on positive time bound commandments? This happens every year, but does a woman make a bracha on the luav? The Shulchan Aruch says they cannot. Reb Moses Isserles says they can. So the Ashkenazic women make the bracha. The Sephardic women in many communities didn't. However, despite the Shulchan Aruch's position that women do not make the bracha, the fact is that in many Sephardic communities, women did make the bracha. And this practice preceded the Shulchan Aruch. And it was supported by many outstanding Sephardic poskim. Yet for decades, Rav Avadia was insistent that all women in the land of Israel must stop making the bracha. Not even in the land of Israel. For this, he held that even in diaspora. So who's the radical here? It seems to me it's Rav Avadia Yosef trying to uproot practices that have been in existence for hundreds and hundreds of years, even before the Shulchan Aruch, and he's saying you have to get rid of them. Now, while some rabbinic figures were able to stand up against Rav Avadia, we spoke the other night about Rav Shalom Messas, most simply fell into line. I heard from Rabbi Shama that the Syrian community basically abandoned their practices and fell into line with Rav Avadia. It happened in Israel in a few different ways. First of all these kids being educated in the Shas school system, they began to follow Rav Avadia's approach. Also, you have his son wrote a new Shulchan Aruch. It's called the Yalkut Yosef. I'm sure you have it here. This became the standard work for most of the Sephardim. And thirdly, all the Sidurim published by Rav Avadia and his sons, it's really, you can call it Team Rav Avadia. In a multi-front way, they were able to change Sephardic practices and almost create a completely unified Land of Israel practice. Most Sephardim fall into line. Not all. But most did. The Moroccans held out to a certain extent. The Iraqis didn't really. The Syrians, I'm told, didn't. And generally, even among the groups that held out, when they were educated in the school system, many of them fell into line. Let me give you another example where Rav Avadia took on a widespread Sephardic practice. Lighting candles Friday night. According to the common and most likely understanding of the Shulchan Aruch, one is supposed to say the blessing and then light the candles. Ashkenazim do it differently. Rav Avadia rules that this is how Sephardic women must operate. Make the blessing and then light the candles. However, in many Sephardic communities, the practice was just like the Ashkenazim. You light it and then make the blessing. And this practice was even supported by the Chidah. Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who I mentioned, was the last great Sephardic leader. And yet Rav Avadia insisted that every woman must abandon her practice. And this is what Rav Shama told me. I mean, this led to widespread abandonment. And think what this means. By the way, the Ben Ish Chai also defended the practice of doing it where you light and then make the bracha. Lighting Shabbos candles is enveloped with holiness for women. They get it from their mothers. I mean, this is a tradition. Do you know what it means to take on such a tradition? And do you know what it means that women are willing? Women who've been doing it this way for 50 years even, were told to give it up, and they gave it up. You know what that means? Only someone like Rav Avadia could have that, could say the chutzpah almost, to make such a demand of these older women. He's not just saying it for the young people. He's even the older women, change of practice they do in their whole life, and only someone with the authority and someone who the public loved so much would women be able to say, you know what, even though my grandmother did it one way, my mother did it one way, I'm going to change it because Chacham Avadia told me to. That, more than anything else, shows what a figure he was. No other figure could have done something like that, that women would give up the way they would the Shabbos candles. And by now, as I said, his victory is nearly complete. He was able to do almost the impossible, influence thousands and thousands of people to change well-entrenched practices. Let me say, finally, a word about the most incredible feature of Rav Avadia Yosef's writings, and that's his incredible bekiyut, vast knowledge, erudition. If you haven't yet read his writings, there's something in there which you find nothing else. He'll have a response in which literally thousands of sources are cited, or many hundreds into the thousands, definitely over 1,000. Now, we've had great Bekiyim in the past, names you may have never heard of even, Yosef Chaya Stern, Chaim Palachi. But neither of them can compare to Rav Avadia because they're over 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And in the intervening 150 years, let's say 130 years, more volumes of responsa have been published in the last even 100 years than were published in all the years before put together. And Rav Avadia mastered them all. The knowledge that his mind encompassed is truly beyond belief. It's the product of an unequaled memory that has no need for the various CD-ROMs and websites that make Bekiyut less valuable today. Today, Bekiyut is not so valuable because you can go online, you have Otsar HaChachma, you have all these databases that help you. It's not so valuable. Rav Avadia didn't need any of that. Now, I was asked, did I ever encounter such a mind in academia? And I have not, but this got me thinking about how Rav Avadia would be viewed in the academic world. And I think this helps us understand why the Lithuanian yeshiva world was never blown over by Rav Avadia. They never were overwhelmed by him. take an example. Take some of the great Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. Take, for example, Rav Aaron Cutler. Had he not remained in the yeshiva world, he could have used his great intellect to become a scientist or a mathematician, anything. He was a genius. In fact, his sister, who was a communist, wanted him to get him out of the yeshiva world. The rest of her whole life, she just said, well, he could have been a great professor of mathematics and said he's a Muhammad. You know, his sister... Yes, he didn't... she didn't appreciate him. But he could have. Could have been anything. From Joseph Soloveitchik. Anything he set his mind to. He could have achieved, you know, a great philosopher, you know, all this. And the same can be said about the other great Lithuanian Torah geniuses. But when you look at Rav Avadia, you don't see analytical brilliance. What you were impressed with is the photographic memory. And by the standards of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, you know, that doesn't measure for so much. And that's really the challenge that Rav Avadia presents to the Lithuanian yeshiva world, where for good or bad, his type of knowledge is helpful, but it's not regarded as the pinnacle of Torah study. From the Lithuanian perspective, Rav Avadia is a great technician. He's able to gather various sources, put them together, but there's no grand theories here, no great chidushim in the classic Lithuanian sense in his responsa, which overwhelm you with their breath, but you don't get this brilliance. You can find, if you look in Rav Avadia's writings, on almost every page, he'll cite a text and a responsum, and then he'll say it's not muchrach or not mechuvar, that it's not clear, and then he'll cite 10 sources that disagree with it. But he hardly ever explains why the rejected opinion is wrong. He'll simply show you the other opinion to disagree, he'll make little, what we call diukim. At the end of the day, from the Lithuanian perspective, there's something deeply unsatisfying with rejecting a viewpoint because most other people disagree with it. If I'm Rav Moshe Feinstein, let's say, and I write something, and Rav Avadia says, well, it's not clear what I wrote, and cites, you know, 10 other sources, including from the 18th, 17th century, you disagree with me, I'm going to say, okay, fine, you showed me that there's 10 sources that disagree, but show me how my understanding of the Rambam is incorrect. You know, for the Lithuanian perspective, you know, the numbers, you know, Rav Avadia, he uses a lot of numbers. He balances authorities off each other. He looks at, you know, how many majority rules. That really doesn't value much in the Lithuanian world. They're looking at, quality of writing and quality of the chidush, and you don't have much of that in Rav Avadia. It's a different way of writing. And I will tell you, there's other things, you know, which are problematic in his writings. For example, he talks about the Shulchan Aruch, but he himself doesn't always follow the Shulchan Aruch. And he does, it's a sort of, there's a sort of manipulation of the halakha in his writings, not in a bad way, but the word manipulate, not in a bad sense, but I'll show you, for example, what I mean. Rav Avadia Yosef uses the principle often of svek sveka. Svek sveka means double doubt. That is, if there's a double doubt on two matters, you can rule leniently. And since he knows everything, you know, if there's a dispute among sages, he'll say, well, that's a doubt. And then you just find another doubt. It's always easy to find a doubt. But when it comes to the Shulchan Aruch, he even rules that you can use a double doubt against the Shulchan Aruch. And I'll explain to you how this works in practice. Even though the Shulchan Aruch disagrees with both these doubts. For example, according to the Shulchan Aruch, for the Ashkenazim, there's this idea called Bishul Akum. A non-Jew was not allowed to cook for us. You know, the parameters of this are debated, but everyone assumes that there's some notion that a non-Jew can't cook for you. So for the Ashkenazim, there's a heter that, and this is what they do in the restaurants, the Jew lights the stove. Non-Jew lights the stove. No, the Jew lights the stove. Not Jew lights the stove. And the non-Jew cooks. Shulchan Aruch says that's forbidden. You can't do that. Okay, so according to the Shulchan Aruch, a Sephardi cannot eat, therefore, at any of these restaurants. You can't eat if I invite him to my house. Maybe when I have a non-Jew helping me cook, he can't eat here. Now that's a problem for a Kol Yisrael Posek or for Avad Yosef. But Rav Avadia says, no, he can eat at the restaurant, and he can eat at the Simcha. Why? How could he eat at the Simcha if it was cooked in a way the Shulchan, because he says there's a Svek Sveka. Suffek number one is that maybe this is not considered Bishul Akum, because there's an idea that Bishul Akum only applies, in a social setting, but not an employee. Now the Shulchan Aruch rejects that. But he still says, but other people disagree, so it's still a Safek. And then there's the second Safek. I forget what the second Safek is now. What's the second Safek? I don't remember the second. He throws a second one in, both of which are rejected by the Shulchan Aruch. And yet he says, nevertheless, we're allowed to apply Svek Sveka to the Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, the upshot is that at the end of the day, you can eat also Glatt Kosher. It's the same thing. He says that if you're invited to someone's house and they don't serve Glatt Kosher, the Sephardi can eat there. How can a Sephardi eat there? The Shulchan Aruch says you can't. Well, Svek Sveka. One of the Safeks is that perhaps the Halacha is not like the Shulchan Aruch. Perhaps you don't need got kosher. And the other suffix is maybe this particular animal didn't have any problems. So here Rav Avadya is willing to use this idea of sfek sfeika, even when the Shulchan Aruch rejects the suffix and paskins, he's willing to use it. So he does, for reasons which I can't explain, because in theory you could use this consistently. Every single psak of the Shulchan Aruch, basically, pretty much everyone, you can find someone who disagrees. And therefore you can make, as he was criticized, people said you can make a sfek sfeika on almost everything. You can make a sfek all over the place. Rav Avadya is very careful, and he never actually explains why in certain cases. I think we can see why, though. In the cases I just gave you, you know, what, we could say that a Sephardi can never come to an Ashkenazi simcha? Because, you know, the cooking is done in accordance with, Bishalakum. I mean, you could see... at least that's how I see it. For the Kol Yisrael sensibility, that's where he's willing to rely on these sfek sfeikas. Let me conclude by saying that I've really just touched the surface of Rav Avadya Yosef. Truth, he wasn't just a man, he was a phenomenon. Before our very eyes, we were able to see the creation of a halachic tradition that I believe permanently altered the course of Torah history. This is the sort of thing that only comes about a few times in a millennium, and we saw it. And I think we have to feel very worthy that we were able to see such a thing happen before our life. Now, and for the rest of history, people are going to be studying these writings, and of course, how it develops, we'll have to remain and see, wait and see. But there's no question that the Sephardic trajectory has been permanently altered. The halachic trajectory has been permanently altered in the Sephardic world. Thank you very much. And now we have time for some comments, questions.
Yeah.
That's easy. It's easier if I just separate. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I won't remember. Yeah. No. He has the child who's the chief rabbi now, Rav Yitzhak Yosef. He's also a great scholar. No question about it. He's a great. Unlike the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, who's a young guy, as my age, and had no business being chief rabbi, but it's nothing to do with scholarship anymore. The son, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, is a great, great Talmid Chacham, but he doesn't have the charisma. He doesn't have the following of his father. He's as close as you can get, perhaps. But there are great scholars among his son, also Rav David Yosef in Har Nof, but it's not the same. But I don't know if you need it so much, because they've already created the literature. They have the Shulchan Aruch, the Alkud Yosef, they have the school system. As long as people are still being educated in that, they just like after Yosef Karo died, there wasn't anyone like Yosef Karo, but it was already set in motion. Unless something comes along to totally uproot this, what we're going to have from now on are Sephardi children being educated in Rav Avadya Yosef's halachic opinions. And the whole Tunisian community fell in line. Rav Mazuz and the rest, they have their own community, their own tradition. And yet he says, Rav Mazuz, who's the leader of the Tunisians, says that in the land of Israel we follow Rav Avadya. I mean, that's an amazing thing. Even the Yemenites, to a certain extent, did it. Yeah, we'll get to you. Just say, yeah. To a certain extent, yeah. Yeah. No, I don't. He didn't weigh in. I'm not sure why he didn't. Rav Amsalam weighed in. And that created a big controversy. If you look at Rav Avadya's writings, he's clear that you convert people who are involved, let's say, with non-Jews. He says it explicitly. He talks about, we even have him on Knesset testimony from the 1970s talking about the liberal view of conversion. But he and his sons never got involved in the Russian thing. And it's a bit of a mystery, because Rav Amsalam in his book says that he's following Rav Avadya Yosef's principles on what you do, that you convert these people and you don't need to reach to the sky. It is a question why he did get involved with the army conversions. He didn't get... It could be politics, but, I'm talking about even after the Neman Commission. I'm talking about Rav Amsalam's book. It was only about 4 years ago. I don't know why he never protested, by the way, either. You know, what the Batei Din were doing. So he didn't. He kept silent this whole time. And I don't have an answer for the Russian situation there. It's a good point. It seemed to fall. I mean, well, he never. Well, you know, the question is, Well, these people were not Jewish, so it's a different sort of thing of Kol Yisrael. You know, it's we're talking about bringing people in. Kol Yisrael, in a sense, that when I say Kol Yisrael, a concern for all Jews, whatever their level of religiosity, this is different. This is about people who aren't even Jewish. It makes it more complicated, but, you know, the army conversions were conversions of Russians. And that, he said, that, but even there, he wasn't proactive. It's after it happened, and then it was brought to him, he put the rubber stamp on it. He did have more Haredi tendencies in recent years. By the way, one of the other questions that was showed the Kol Yisrael, he was asked about weddings which don't have mechitzas. So he says, you know, you should have mechitzas, but if the family doesn't want to, okay, so you put the families together and this. You know, it's, again, always showing the Kol Yisrael. It's a good question about the Russian. He never, because maybe it could be that he only believed really in conversion when the people were involved. For these young people, the army, they're going to be married. He didn't believe in conversion, just stomp to convert every Tom, Dick, and Harry. If people, though, were coming and they were involved with a non-Jewish girl, then he believed in conversions. The Russian issue was they wanted to convert everyone, lock, stock, and barrel. The better solution probably would have been to convert all the children. Moshe Feinstein holds, in opposition to many others, that you can convert any single child. It doesn't matter if it's a religious home or not, because it still is a chut, a better thing to be a Jew. They're not to be a Jew. And that, they can convert all these Russian children, and that would solve the whole problem. But they don't do that. In fact, in Israel, you cannot adopt a child. It's amazing when you think of it. The majority of the Israeli population cannot adopt a child and have the child converted. What you're saying is that the majority of the Israeli population cannot have a Jewish child. Because the Bat Din in Israel will not convert children of non-religious parents. And yet, Rav Moshe Feinstein held that 100% this could be done. Well, you know, I don't know. As far as I know, Rav Avadya didn't deal with the children thing. Their thing has always been the marriage thing. This is the old Sephardic approach. You convert people for the sake of marriage. This goes back to the Rambam. Maimonides already said, you convert for the sake of marriage. There's a famous response of Maimonides about this. You want to say? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mr. Soto, right? Yeah. No. Rav Avadya Yosef is a posek and a halachist, so much so that when he was in Yeshiva Parat Yosef, Rav Ben Zion Uziel, the Sari Chief Rabbi, was giving classes on the Kuzari, and he didn't go to the classes because all he wanted to do was study halacha and Talmud. It's a lacuna, perhaps, but he is no philosophy, no theology. He's a posek, yeah. Why? Because the land of Israel is called Atrei de Maran. It's the land of the Shulchan Aruch. So therefore, assuming you force him on, he's not forcing him on. He himself doesn't say you have to. He's never tried to force his decisions on. He thinks that in theory, all Sephardim should follow because they, in theory, should follow him. But he never said that the Ashkenazim have to follow Shulchan Aruch. Well, he thinks it would be better. That's my point, which I made before. And you could. You can't go the other way. You can't become Ashkenazi in the land of Israel. That's absolutely not allowed. Look, Rav Avadya, I told this. There's a story. I mentioned it the other day to Mr. Azulai that it's told his story. I don't think it's a true story, but it says something about Rav Avadya. When in Netanya, all the gangs were killing each other, so he had two of the gang leaders come to see him. It's told as a true story, but I don't think it's a true story, but it says something. So he says, I understand Jews killing Jews, but Sephardim killing Sephardim? That I don't understand. He is a Sephardic ethnocentrist. There's no question. He believes that the Sephardic approach is better. But he doesn't say that the Ashkenazim have to abandon their approach. He says it would be better if they abandoned their learning approach. And he does think, as I said, that you can become Sephardi. And he thinks that, in theory, that this is the way it should be because the land of Israel, the only reason that the Ashkenazim are allowed to continue their practices, he says, is for one reason. They came as a whole community after the Holocaust. If they came as an individual, and this is the way it used to be, when you came as a small group, you had to, according to Halacha, adopt the approach of the Shulchan Aruch, because just like when you come to a shul, you have to adopt the Minhag of the Mishul. The Ashkenazim get a heter in his mind because they came as large groups. But, you know, this is and in Mashiach's time, everyone's going to be a Sephardi. Because in Mashiach's time, we're going to get rid of all these things and it's going to go back to the Shulchan Aruch's approach, the way it should be. This is what we call Atrei de Maran, the land of Maran. He's the boss of in the land of Israel. Any other? You want to say one more question? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think so. It's a hard thing, but I think a couple things. First of all, understand that Rav Avadya Yosef, when he would speak, see, one thing he was quite naive, I think, is that he didn't realize, even in however much they told him, that everything he said was being taped and out there. When he was in that group, and he had to be there, it was a couple hundred people, but these were his people. And he spoke in a way to them, he spoke like a language, a rhetoric, and this is how in the Middle Eastern countries they speak. So it's no question the things he said were inappropriate, but you have to understand, you know, he's a man who Mubarak liked him very much. He would go, Mubarak summoned him, and he went to see Mubarak. He, you know, he doesn't think that all Arabs are snakes. He had a lot of respect. He even gave Mubarak a bracha, and that, you know, this government would fall before Mubarak dies, and before Mubarak will get out, and the government will fall. Whatever he said, it came true, because Morsi fell. In other words, he had respect. But he would speak sometimes in a certain low fashion, gutter talk, for example. And that was, so leave that. But even putting that aside, it is true. He said things that are problematic. And I think we have to say that people are complicated. And there's a teacher at Machon Hadar in New York who wrote something on Rav Avadya after his passing. And this is a conservative, like, or post-conservative institution. It's not an Orthodox. And he said that, you know, he admires Rav Avadya very much. And after his death, a lot of people were saying negative things. And he says, but we have to understand that people are complicated. And I agree. Rav Avadya said certain things that we don't appreciate, we don't agree with. But, you know, you take the totality of the man. Look, Richard Nixon said he did great things for Israel, but privately he said all sorts of terrible things about the Jews. I mean, we know Thomas Jefferson did terrible things. People are complicated. Norman Lamb. Who did more greater things than Norman Lamb? For modern Orthodoxy, for Yeshiva University. And now we know in the last few months they did something which wasn't so good. Are we going to say that that destroys all his good, that this? I think we need to take people into, and when you deal with someone like Vivadia, who for his entire life did so much good and was dedicated, he had a problem that she said certain things, and you know, he didn't even mean the things he said. That's the thing. He said things, he didn't really mean it. He'd say about Shamir, you know, he should, you know, things like that. He didn't really mean it. This is just his way of letting off steam. We expect more from a rabbi. It's no question, especially the leading rabbi. But, you know, that's why I think you can separate it. We're not dealing with a racist. I mean, he's the man who stood up for Ethiopian Jews. We're not dealing with someone who hated Arabs. I mean, he had plenty of relations. I mean, it's a complicated person who didn't know to hold his views sometimes. That's all I can say. It's a defect a little bit, but we all have defects, and it takes away a little bit. But I don't think in 100 years, like I said, people are going to be so concerned with that, and I don't think it should be blown out of proportion. This wasn't the way he lived his life. And he would make, every now and then, every few months, he'd make one of these crazy statements. And, you know, what can I say? And he never made it before he went into politics. I don't know. As he got older, some people think that maybe as he got older, you know, older people say certain things. He was saying it, you know, he'd lose his temper as he got, there's a YouTube video of him losing his temper and Aryeh Deri trying to calm him down. I mean, like I said, he's complicated, as all great figures are complicated.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro.